Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I am your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
And we are driving back from GP Vegas.
We are literally on the road. I've hooked up a recording equipment. It's in my lap. I'm holding a microphone and holding a microphone up to Ben's mouth.
And I am involved in the podcast in a semi-dangerous way.
Yeah. Because driving and podcasting at the same time, the best idea we've ever had.
You can't hold a cell phone while driving, but you can certainly hold a microphone.
So we just went to GP Vegas. It was awesome. Congratulations to Ben. You made day two.
I finished 96th out of about 3,800 in my Grand Prix. There were two Grand Prix. So that was my first day two. And as well as my first day two, my first like deep Grand Prix finish in the top 3% of a tournament. So I felt pretty good about that.
Yeah, so for you guys, for everyone who doesn't know, the way the GP was breaking out, it was so incomprehensively large at almost 9,000 players that they had to split it into two separate GPs. There was like the Planeswalker Origins cards that were kind of basically a blind advertisement for the next set, Magic Origins, and then there was the Modern Masters Legends side of the room, which was all the like different legendary creatures and mythics from the most recent, or from Modern Masters.
He's talking about the banners that were hanging above each section to denote which of the two GPs. There, you said cards.
Right.
There were no cards from
Origins. Yeah. And on top of that, though, each section, like, each GP was also separated into, like, a bunch of little miniature small GPs. Like, you were in, like, Gideon, and I was in V-Click, and there was, like, someone
in
GP.
Yeah, there were, like, sealed flights that were, like, 1,000 people each, or, like, 900 people. It was pretty much, totally ridiculous. Like, if you've ever been to a very, very, very large convention, like San Diego Comic-Con, it was sort of like being in the main hall at San Diego Comic-Con, where walking from one side of the room to the other side of the room takes you 5 to 10 minutes. It's not like a women's club gym or, like, some of these GPs where it's, a large convention center room, but you can kind of see everything. I got lost.
Right, you're in like
a high school
gym versus like the Las Vegas Convention Center, like fully open to like this giant event where there's hundreds of vendors. I got a bunch of cards signed. I got my Brainstorms and my Thoughtseize signed by like the original artist. Like there are 12 original art, or I think there were like 30 original artists at the event.
There was
like
no dead space. Is the other crazy
thing?
Yeah. The whole entire ballroom was full of vendors and all. There's all kinds. It was a pretty insane event. Definitely was very worth going. We had a really good time. So I think maybe should we just kind of start from the beginning and we'll guys kind of walk you through what it was like and some of the exciting moments.
Yeah, so why don't we each walk through like what our pools were. Obviously yours are more interesting because you actually made day two. So then quickly I'll start. I went X3. I didn't even drop it. Went to the last round, but the soul crushing last round, last loss, so I couldn't make day two.
One match away from day two.
It's actually really interesting. The X2 bracket might be the most depressing Magic I've ever played in my life, because every single person you played, it's either you lose and your dreams are crushed, or you're literally crushing the dreams of the opponent across from you. Like all day I was like, oh, here, you check out my podcast. At that point I was like, I don't want to make you feel worse, so I'm just gonna quietly shuffle my deck and put it in my box and go away.
And I have no dignity, so I crushed people's dreams and gave them the business card for our podcast anyway.
Right. So my pool, I did the black red aggro deck. So like, doing research on this format ahead of time, this is still relevant because it's on Modo now. I read articles that like you either want to be five colors where you're playing every good card you have, or you want to try and be as aggressive as possible if you don't have the five color deck. So I didn't have great fixing, so I went towards the black red strategy with some splashes at the top end for I forget what it's called, but it you get to regrowth a card from your graveyard and either do damage to your opponent or a creature for that much. Cost 6 mana.
Vengeful Rebirth, it's called.
Yeah, Vengeful Rebirth. And it does, it's a great top-end curve. But let's talk about your seal pool.
So I'm sitting there, and I show up, and I ask them which flight I'm in, because my name's not on the registration sheet. And they say, you are in here. It's just not on the sheet for whatever reason. You go sit there at that other table by yourself. The table is going to be for the sleep-in special people, the people with buys. Kessler and I did not have any buys. So I sat there by myself with my pool. Say what?
We will now, yeah.
I sat there by myself, and I was like, okay, like, that's cool. These cards that I opened are kind of mediocre and not very good. And normally at a major tournament, what they have you do is after you register the pool, you then pass your pool, your cards, the guy across from you, and they shuffle it all up. who has what pool, and you end up with somebody else's cards. This is to, like, eliminate cheating and preferencing your own pool. Because I was sitting at a table by myself, when they made the announcement, okay, guys, just kidding, you're all keeping the cards you opened, it was just, like, a surprise.
Right.
I was like, oh, no, because my pool was just not good. I think I had one rare that was playable and a bunch of crap.
Okay.
But the guy comes over to me, and he's like, ah, we're going to switch your pool because you're sitting by yourself. I was like, oh, okay. Oh,
nice.
Sweet. So he comes back. I'm the only person in the entire hall that gets my own pool, or that gets to switch. He walks back over. He's like, you're going to like this a lot more. So I look at it. I've got Elishnorn, Grand Zenobiat. I have a regular Indomitable Archangel, as well as a foil Indomitable Archangel.
Which that's the rare that used to be a mythic that gives all artifacts you control hexproof, but it's also just a 4-mana 4/4 flyer.
Yeah, in limited, it's a 2-white, 2-colorless for a 4/4 flyer. I also had Argent Sphinx? Yeah, the Sphinx
the Blinky Metalcraft Sphinx.
The Metalcraft Sphinx with another 4/4 flyer for 4, which is double blue. Those were, I believe, the rares that I played in my pool. I also opened Midnight Banshee and Ghost Council of Orzhova, but I didn't play either of them because the color requirements to go double black in my pool were too much.
Right.
I had an Electrolyze. I had a Burst Light, 2 Burst Lightnings. I had also a Vengeful Rebirth. I had a Mole Drifter.
So you had, like, just the Stone Cold Nuts.
I had a lot of really good cards.
Right.
But something I learned at this tournament from other people with good pools, and something that I think I have learned in my life as a Magic player, is you can't really credit success to just opening good cards in sealed. It helps a lot, but you won't go in a 9-round day one. You will not win 7 rounds if you don't play well.
Right. I mean, like, so my pool had some great cards. I had Bitter Blossom. I had Profane Command. I had Edrixar. Like, I had all these great cards. I didn't get the day two. So, like, a great pool does not necessarily mean a great finish.
A 6-3 is pretty good. 6-3, you were a match away.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I did well, but I'm saying, like, in general, it's not a guarantee. And I played people with way better pools that I stomped over, and I played people with way worse pools that beat me.
Yeah, so I built my deck, and I looked at it, and there was the makings of a black-white kind of semi-aggressive deck because I had a couple Spirits cards, and I had, like I said, I had all these strong white cards, plus Midnight Banshee and also Ghost Council. So in my mind, I was like, okay, I can go with this 5-color deck because I had opened 2 Sphere of the Suns, 3 Sphere of the Suns, and 2 Rampant Growths and 4 Bounce Lands. I was like, I can go with this big, slow 5-color deck with lots of removal and bombs, or I can try to do this black-white deck, because realistically, the black-white deck could still play a bunch of sweet cards. It just wouldn't have been quite as powerful. So I had both built and both sleeved up, and I played my first round with the 5-color deck, and I lost the first game, and I second-guessed myself, and
why don't you break down? So, like, I know most of the day probably we won't go through, but I do want to, like, walk through that. This first loss was kind of
soul-crushing.
Soul-crushing.
Because historically at Magic tournaments, I play Constructed events.
Right.
And I play them with Bruise. So losing the first round is a feeling I'm very familiar with. And I had this, like, not again kind of feeling.
Right.
Where I was just like, I opened all these good cards, and I can't even win the first round. And this guy I was playing against, you know, his deck was pretty good. He ended up going X2 throughout the day, which is pretty good. It's probably why my breakers were pretty decent in the end. My one loss at the beginning was to a good player. His deck was solid. He top decked extremely well. One game he drew Profane Command and Banefire in back-to-back draws, and I had him at 1, and the Banefire killed me. I mean, it only did 1, but
right.
I then sideboarded into a bad black-white deck, like I said, which I didn't need to do. But
well, I do want to talk about that. So, like, a lot of pros, and sometimes this is something to really consider. When you get a sealed pool, the way these major events work is you have to build your pool. No one talked. We mentioned this before. You can't talk to anyone. So it's very possible that you've made mistakes. But because it's competitive REL, you can't start a match without the exact same set of cards every single time. In fact, our friend Jimmy got a game loss because he accidentally left a card in between rounds. So a lot of what pros do is like, oh, I realized I should have built this super hyper-aggressive strategy, or my strategy is so controlly that if I'm in a bad matchup, I should just switch it up so that their sideboard cards aren't as good. And this is a switch you can make, but sometimes it's a giant mistake because you don't really have that secondary deck, and you're maybe thinking you're being too clever or being too cute actually switching to a new strategy.
Like, to be like what I did
in
do,
this first round.
I misbuilt my pool by 4 cards. I think I went over it with AJ Soccer, who's like a pretty awesome pro, really cool dude. I think we might have him on the cast at some point, but after I had turned in my list and I was about to play my first round, he looked over my pool and he's like, yeah, I think your pool is pretty much correct. You should be playing these 2 bounce lands. Like, they're just really good. You're controlly, like, they're off color, but just play them anyway. And then he was like, and these two cards could be these two cards. I took three of his four suggestions, and every single game throughout the entire tournament, I switched those three cards out into game two. So that's, like, pretty normal.
Right.
You realize your deck is probably a little off. So the one thing I will say, instead of recounting any gameplay memories from that first round, because I don't really remember the round super well.
Wait, this is, like, 8 a.m. after getting in the night before late and, like, possibly having a little bit of fun because we're in Vegas. Like, you're not awake.
Wait, I mean, I got in Thursday night. We hung out right there. Friday night, we had, like, a few drinks. We didn't get too crazy. Got to sleep at a reasonable hour. I actually got out of bed at 6:45 a.m. day of the tournament, went and worked out for 2 hours, and then got to the tournament, which seemed, like, pretty ballsy to do. But I sort of felt like it would be good for me to kind of get the blood flowing and wake up. So,
yeah, I mean, like, at that point, you're actually, like, kind of ready for the tournament versus me, who I'm, like, two Trenta iced coffees deep, maybe into a third venti at that point. Like, literally, we have some footage of you playing. Like, I walked over towards later in the rounds of me filming it, and you can tell how much coffee I've drank in by how much the camera is just shaking because I can't keep my hands still.
So I sideboarded into that weird deck. I lost the game. I then proceeded to rip off 7 match wins in a row. Now, a lot of our buddies that made day two, 10 people from our Westside Magic store, Heidi Ho Comics and Games, 10 of us made day two. That's a pretty ridiculous percentage, yeah,
like,
considering.
Like, I think we're like 18 of us actually
went.
Yeah,
16 or 18.
That's like almost 50% for a single store. That's insane.
And granted, Adam Mancuso's been to like 6 Pro Tours, and Andrew and Eugene are both Grand Prix winners, and, you know, Cliff and
Austin
have both the Pro Tours. Like, I mean, it's a very good group of players. It's not that surprising that a lot of people would make day two.
And you're the host of the Master of Modern podcast. Yeah. You have a better day two on
you, I mean, you were a match away from day two. It's like, so I mean, I would say, like, it's not insanely surprising, but a lot of them had 1 and 2 buys. So they start with a 2-0 record.
Right.
So to actually go 7 in a row like that was pretty nuts. I mean, every game I played Elish Norn, I won. You know, that card is totally ridiculous. Totally.
Well, that's something about this format that I think it's one of my complaints, is the format is built in a way where there are just some, for sealed, there are just some cards, and this is true of a lot of formats, like, you know, Inferno Titan in the M sets that
right.
I was in, and, like, it's just how this kind of works. But there are some cards that's like, oh, you have Elish Norn, so you, like, you basically get 2 buys by opening that card.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, I mean, Comet Storm, Profane Command, Elish Norn, these are the cards that are, if you open them and you look at them, you're like, if I draw this, it will swing the game so wildly when I draw it, probably. You can come back from, I would say, yeah, each of those has the capabilities of completely swinging a game. Like,
right.
Completely. I mean, with Profane, you can get back your best thing they've already killed, kill their best thing, or, like, attack them, they take the damage, kill their best thing, and then drain life them.
Right.
Like, it's pretty bananas what you can do. Same with Comet Storm. You can wipe their whole board or Elish
Storm.
Yeah,
I mean, like, of my 3 losses, 1 was to Mana Screw, 1 was to me being dumb and too much coffee and too late in the night. But, like, 1 to Phil was just like, oh, they cast Karn every turn on turn 4.
Oh, yeah, Karn. He's another card that if you just open, like, him and you cast him.
Can't beat that card.
Very, very hard. Very hard to win. So,
So you went undefeated.
For 7 more rounds.
Right.
And then after, and there was a couple, like, pretty interesting rounds. There was a few things I noticed. So one thing I will point out, guys, is if you're someone who really enjoys playing Magic, and you say you play a lot of Constructed, and maybe you draft with your friends some, and maybe you even do some sealed events, there's a massive difference between that and then sitting down with a new set and expecting to be able to make the right build right at first and know how to play it right away. Because I was surprised at how rusty I felt that first round. Like I said, everything
right.
I told you guys, from second-guessing my deck into the second game, some of the obvious, those few cards I talked about, just, like, obvious stuff, like, yeah, I should be playing Bounce Lands even if they're not entirely on color. Like, they're just good in this deck. Or, like, I think I can remember making one. I missed 2 triggers in that game that were just super stupid misses. I really definitely needed a game to warm up.
Well, and I also think, so, something that you kind of benefit from is the era that Modern Masters comes from is, like, you were playing through that whole era. So, like, I definitely started in Zendikar, and I do think I know some of this format a little bit better because 2 new sets that I started playing with were
right,
in the
right,
format.
Right.
versus last time where it was like a completely fresh slew of cards and I only know them from constructive play.
Sure.
But with this one, like, you played in a lot of these limited environments, and that has to have helped, like, knowing, like, oh, this is why Graft is good. This is how these cards interact with each other.
Yeah, I remember, like, Ravnica very well. Time Spiral I know really well. Lorwyn Morningtide I played a lot of. My like, heyday in terms of, like, when I was first most obsessed with Magic.
And most limited play.
Yeah, I played a ton of Lorwyn Morningtide, Shadowmoor Eventide. I played a tremendous amount of. So, and then, actually, the I played a lot of New Phyrexia.
Right.
Besieged and a lot of New Phyrexia. So yeah, I definitely knew the cards well, but I had really, really good cards. So I made it to that last round, and there was only one round. The ninth round of the day was the only round that I legitimately felt like I lost fair and square. Like,
when I have footage of, this is the one I had footage where my hands were shaking, but, like, the guy basically had your deck, but with slightly better, like, slightly more rares on color that he was playing.
He had the same White Angel. He had, like, just
Humble Magnets, a lot of arrests.
Yeah, he just had a really, really, really good blue-white artifact deck with great disruption, counter spells, aggressive creatures, the right curve. Just the kind of thing that...
There's a reason he's X1 also. Like, the other thing is, like, every single round you go undefeated, every single round becomes more difficult. Like, one of the things I did notice at this GP, and I think one of the reasons it was so easy to, like, do well in the beginning, if you got lucky, is, like, the field is much looser than a normal Grand Prix.
Right.
Because, like, there is a ton of people that are just playing in this event because it's the biggest event of all time. And they're not generally GP grinders. They're just like, okay, it's time for me. I just want to come hang out and have fun playing Mario Masters at a GP. And so, like, it's a lot easier on day one to kind of get through it.
There's also a lot of little things, guys. Like, for instance, if you're a Moto player, there's a few things that happen throughout the weekend. Like, you played Narcolepsy on someone's creature. It's your responsibility to tap that creature during upkeep. And if you're on Moto, it gives you a prompt. But in person, in like, you know, in real life Magic, you have to know to do that. And I saw a lot of stuff happen. It just little things like that where, you know, a good player is going to catch it, might swing the game if they miss it. I finished the first day, you know, X2, felt really good about it. Went and got, you know, a good amount of sleep. Woke up, worked out again the next morning just to kind of repeat the cycle. It showed up.
I slept in.
Yeah. So the way day two works is they shrink it down. Of the 3,800 people in day one, 379, I think, or right?
Per pot. So there was 700 and X, some amount, like eight maybe, players in day two.
You had
mind you, GP San Diego, the one we went to a couple of years back, had less players in day one than this GP had in day two.
Yeah, I mean, pretty just totally insane, the size of this thing. And about 10% of... day one makes day two. So you show up, they put you into a draft pod. You're going to draft twice with three rounds each draft, and then if you make it to top eight, you get a top eight draft. And obviously Modern Masters is a money set, so it's definitely exciting to be, you know, getting two free Modern Masters drafts. But you want to win, and I've never made day two of a Grand Prix, and it's draft, and I've drafted this at about five times, so I didn't really know exactly what to expect, but I assume that the competition was going to be pretty tough. There were some sweet players in my pod. You know, our friend Eugene, who's been on the pod before, you know, Grand Prix winner. He was in my, you know, day two of my side. Patrick Chapin, Paul Rietzel, Paulo Vitor Di Domarosa. I think Reed Duke may have been in there. So there was definitely some good players. Paul Cheon, Dave Williams. I think they were all in my side.
Right.
So anyway, my first draft, I show up to no pros. I didn't recognize anybody. You know, I wasn't super intimidated. I knew I didn't want to draft blue. Blue is a color that in this format is, like, not that sweet. It has some good synergies. The multicolor blue strategies are good, but...
I like blue either in the artifact deck or as a third color.
Exactly.
Like, we were talking the night before, like, doing draft strategies, and we definitely were on board with, like... It's almost worth it to pass Cryptic Command or V-Click because you put your opponent in blue. But if you have Cryptic Command, then you just want to go really hard into the artifact theme because it's the only good blue aggressive deck, and it's the only one that really will capitalize on what Cryptic Command's doing for you.
Yeah, I believe what I did is I knew that the five-color green strategy is good. Domain, everybody kind of knew that. And everybody knows that the spirit strategy, the black-white spirit strategy, is sort of the one that if you can get it, if you can get the right cards for it, it's very, very, very hard to lose because you just have so much. Your long game is great. Your inevitability is fantastic. So I took green and white cards early. I think I took a rest first pick. I may have taken a Scatter of the Seeds or Kozilek's Predator or something like that second pick. Because I was like, okay, I like the green white token strategy a lot. I got a Sunlance. I was passing blue cards. I passed a bunch of Water Servants and like fourth or fifth pack. I can remember passing a Plaxcaster Frogling. No, not Plaxcaster. I'm sorry. Lore Scale Kotal. That's the one green, one blue, one colorless 2/2 that whenever you draw a card, put a +1/+ counter on him.
Which I found has been pretty bad in the format when I played it. Because I've had one at least 3 times, and like every single time I'm like, oh, this does nothing. I set it out every game.
It's a powerful card. It's not a card you're going to take like 4th overall unless you know your strategy. It's really good in the graph deck because it's obviously a fat creature that can fly and be protected because it gets counters on it. But I passed it because I didn't want to be in those colors, and I was already in green-white. So then I end up opening Plaxcaster Frogling in like the 7th or 8th pack, or it was passed to me in the 7th or 8th pack. Now, Plaxcaster Frogling, for those that don't remember, is a card from Ravnica Block, and it's a high skill level card to play.
It's pretty good, though.
It's really good. It's one green, one blue, one colorless for a graft creature that comes into play with 3+1/+1 counters. So it's 3/3 for 3. His ability is 2 colorless mana, target creature with a +1/+1 counter on it gains Shroud until end of turn. In a graft deck, it's incredibly difficult to kill your creatures if you have him on board. And because he's a 3/3 for 3, he's fairly aggressive anyway. So once I saw that in the pack, it was like 7th, I think. I took him. In the next pack, I think the next pick was Aquastrand Spider. And I had already taken one earlier just as a green creature on 2.
Yeah, that card's really good in the format in general.
So then I was like, okay, I guess green and green-blue. Maybe I can be green-blue-white. We'll see. The Lore Scale Kotal ended up wheeling. I got a Vines of Vastwood, and then Novigen Sages, which is 2 blue, 4 colorless for a graft 4/4 that has the ability 1 colorless, remove 2+1/+1 counters from among creatures you control to draw a card. I got it 4th to last.
So we just passed a abandoned water park that looks like we're just going to be murdered anytime soon. So if we end up dying,
I've been there.
In the podcast,
I've been there before. It's awesome.
All right, so continue.
So then I kind of knew I was in blue-green. I didn't know 100% like just how dominant the deck was going to be, but it seemed like I was falling into the strategy. What ended up happening in packs 2 and 3 was, as well as getting 2 more Plaxcaster Froglings, some good removal, some good bounce, most of the picks I wanted just kind of fell in my lap. The deck just kind of...
Right. That's the other side. That's kind of what... I forget the format, but like often in draft formats, there's just a weak color. But... because it's weak, it'll go heavily underpicked, and then you might just end up with the nutso deck because you're able to get every single card you could possibly need to make that draft strategy work. Actually, I remember it was Dimir in Gatecrash Limited, where like you would just get all of the cards you could possibly need because no one ever wanted to be in Dimir, but Dimir ended up being pretty powerful if you got the exact perfect deck.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised. Like the kind of things that were wheeling, like I got another 4th pick Plaxcaster Frogling in the 2nd pack. Like it was pretty solid. So I didn't think the deck was like super, super amazing. I didn't know what to expect. I ended up 2-0-ing my first round. My second round, I believe in the 2-1-ing. My first opponent in the match.
Right.
I believe the second guy I played. So what ended up happening, guys, is I splashed black because I got 2 Agony Warps. I got a Spread the Sickness. And I got an Endrixar Master Breeder. And I didn't really want to play a third color, but they're such powerful cards that I think I played 1 Agony Warp main deck, and I was pretty tempo-y. I think I had, like, Remand in the deck.
Okay.
So it was a little loose to play the black, but the cards were very powerful. So what ended up happening is in the second match, I played against the green-white tokens deck.
Right.
And it's a very good deck. He beat me in game 1. I was at 3 and I came back. I resolved Endrixar. Then the next turn I resolved the 5 mana Helium Squirter to get 5/1/1s. I was at 3 and his dudes couldn't attack. And I had a really powerful board position because I had Endrixar and I had like a 6-drop creature in hand. Endrixar, for those that don't know, is a 2/2 for 1 black and 4 colorless that states whenever you cast a creature spell, put X/1/1 Thrall tokens on the battlefield. If you control 7 or more Thralls, sacrifice Endrixar.
Right. He was in my day 1 pool. Yeah. He's very, 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 very good.
He's a beast. So
you untap with him, you feel undefeatable.
So what happened was I was actually in a position to win the game, and I went too aggressive to try to get too cute. I attacked with my whole board to bring him to, like, 8, and knowing that he would block and kill, like, the correct number of tokens for me to then resolve Cloud Elemental and get 3 more tokens to keep my Androxar alive. Play Agony Warp, kill his best guy, swing for lethal the next turn. What I didn't realize was if I had just played the 6-6 or the 6-mana creature in my hand, I wouldn't have had to deal with any of that. I would have had far too many blockers for him to even worry about it. Androxar would have died, and I would have had an overwhelming force to kill him with.
Right.
I tried to get cute. I played Cloud Elemental. I tried to kill his guy with Agony Warp. He had Vines of Vastwood.
You got blown out.
Evoked in, scattered the seeds end of turn, and destroyed me.
Okay.
Lost that match, won my third match, finished my first draft 2-1. I really think I could have 3-0'd the draft. It was a play error. It's the kind of thing that you regret, and if I played in a lot of major Grand Prix, if I had time to go to as many as I'd like, that's the kind of play I probably wouldn't make. But, I mean, it's a long day of magic.
It's a lesson to it's something that took me a long time to learn. But being too cute in, like, the things you're trying to do in Magic is most often not the correct thing to do. Being like, oh, it's cool that I can do this, when you're trying to be in competitive and you're at, like, day 2 of a GP, really the best plays are going to be more just, like, how efficiently can I kill my opponent, not how coolly can I kill my opponent. And it's hard because, like, my natural tendencies, I think a lot of players' natural tendencies, is more to do, like, oh, I feel, because, like, people that play Magic are generally people that like feeling smart because they are smart. You're like, oh, I like playing the smart play here, when in really reality, a lot of the time, the actual smart play is the boring play.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. So that was round 1. So at this point, my 7-2 record from day 1 has now become 9-3. At X3, you're no longer in contention for top 8, but you're still in contention for making some money. A tournament this size paid cash down to 230th place.
We just went through the California inspection thing. We don't have any weird, crazy vegetables or fruits that are going to ruin the ecology of California. Not like the lack of rain is really going to make it possible to happen. But you were saying?
Yeah, so that was the end of the first one. So you're going into one more draft. At X3, you're not going to make day 2. The event pays down to, or you're not going to make the top 8. The event pays down to 230th place. And quite honestly, outside of top 16, the money becomes the difference of like $100. So it's pretty relative. You just want to play the best you can. You know, for me, the idea of maybe finishing X3 at a Grand Prix, 15 rounds against some of the best players in the world, was pretty exciting.
Well, this is also the most difficult Grand Prix that reached the top 200 players. Like, 8,000 people. You're top, 90 percentile there?
If
not more than that.
of our personal Grand Prix, or the one I was in the top 3%.
Right.
Total, I guess, that would put me in the top 6%.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel pretty good about being in the top 6% of 8,000 people. But nonetheless, I went into my last round. And for if any of you guys were there and saw me, you may have noticed that I was walking around the entire weekend filming myself and talking to my phone. This is just something I'm doing. I'm going to maybe cut together a little video. I have to watch the footage when I get home and see how it all turned out. But
it'll be on our YouTube channel.
Yeah, it'll go. If I like it, if it's good, I'll put it up. So I had been introducing every one of my opponents and getting footage of a lot of people throughout the weekend. So I go and I look at the pairings for the second draft. I'm thinking, okay, I just took the graph deck. Like maybe I'll get a deck I feel a little better about going into this next round. And I look at the draft pod. It's me, 5 guys I don't recognize, Hall of Famer and Pro Tour champion Paul Rietzel, and Hall of Famer and Pro Tour champion Paolo Vitor Domodorosa. So that was cool. So we sit down, and I introduce the table on my camera. Be like, so guys, this is my draft pod. These are who I'm playing with. There's 2 Hall of Famers in my draft pod. That's pretty cool. They were cool about it. I had already talked to Rietzel earlier in the weekend a little bit about maybe coming on the podcast. And
Rietzel's one of your favorite pro players.
He's one of my all-time favorite pro players. Right. He's a guy that I've actually watched a lot of matches. So I was pretty excited. So we draft.
Yep.
Rietzel sitting to my right, which is cool because it's like, yeah, I'm getting cards passed to me from Rietzel and then passing cards to Rietzel. We do the draft. My first round opponent is neither PV or Rietzel. It's another guy who I beat. His deck was bad.
If you're listening, we're sorry, but
you know, you made day two, round three of GP, so great job.
Oh, I should talk about the deck that I drive.
Yeah, yeah, that would be nice.
Same thing.
But before you go, so, you know, continuing the haunted tour of our trip in the middle of the desert, we left the haunted water park and now are literally at the road Ghost Town. Is it literally the town of Ghost Town?
It's really weird. I've driven through it before, like driven around.
Yep.
It's very odd.
I still think my favorite exit on this drive is the XXYZZ, which is like literally a town that exists, and it's just the last letters of the alphabet.
XXYZZ?
Yep.
It's just the letters they couldn't figure out to use.
Right. It's like, we need a town and, okay. All right. Now back to what you're drafting.
So, same deal. I didn't want to draft blue. I knew that the graph deck was good. Same thing happens where I take off-color cards to start the draft, and I end up just like, I want to say I took Burst Lightning high, then I took Arrest again, second pick, and then I took Electrolyze, and then I got Smoke Braider passed to me, and I was like, I wonder if with a Burst Lightning and an Electrolyze, should I take the Smoke Braider and see what happens? Because I was passing, you know, powerful blue cards, but I was like, I wonder if I start cutting red and red-blue cards if I see any good ones.
Well, getting blue cards late seems to be pretty easy based off of the fact that most people are, like, literally told, do not be playing blue.
Right.
So, like, the red is the color you want to cut if you're going to try going the blue-red elemental list.
So I'd never drafted it. The blue-red elementals list, for any of you guys that don't know, is far and away, if you get it, the most explosive list you can get in Modern. Even in Modern Masters, even more so than Affinity. Affinity is very powerful.
More than black-red, even, you think?
Oh, yeah. Because elementals, because of what Smoke Braider does in terms of mana efficiency with the deck, it's so bananas. So Smoke Braider, for those who don't know, is one red, one colorless for a 1/1 elemental that states tap, add 2 mana of in any combination of colors to your mana pool, spend this mana only to cast elemental spells or activate abilities of elementals. It's like the most disgusting mana creature in the world if you get the right deck.
And completely unplayable if you don't get the right deck.
Exactly. It's a 1/1 for 2.
So it's swingy. All right, continue.
So it's like totally my kind of card.
Yeah.
So I took Smoke Braider. Then I was passed another Smoke Braider. And as the draft went on, the cards just kept wheeling. I ended up getting 4 Smoke Braiders. I ended up getting 2 Soulbright Flamekin, which is the 1 red, 1 colorless, 2/1, who has a 2 mana colorless ability. Target creature gains trample at the end of turn. If this is the third time this ability has resolved, add 8 mana to your mana pool. So simultaneously, you can trample your whole team and turn 6 into 8. Smoke Braider can activate that ability.
Would you say that Smoke Braider is your red Grand Architect?
Yes. I've always loved that card. I have like 19 of them sitting in my collection in LA because it's one of the few commons I refuse to throw away.
Okay, so it sounds like you've finished the draft and somehow lucked into, like, both drafts you like. You shouldn't draft blue, but I'm going to draft blue because, like, it's pretty open in these formats, and you've gone kind of the nuts elemental deck. How did the rest of the matches go?
So the first match I played against a guy that took a really, really slow artifact deck.
Okay.
And it was like an artifact blue, white, black deck, I think.
Like Tumble Magnets and other kind of charge counter based.
You know, he had like Flare Husk, Cathodians, the 2/2 flyer for 4, Fairy Mechanist who checks the top 3 cards for an artifact, puts it in your hand.
Okay. Shout out to anyone in Barstow. We're currently passing you right now.
His deck was just slow. My deck was so fast that, like, I mean, to give you guys a sense of, like, some of the hands and things you can do, there was a turn mid-game in that game where I had 2 Smoke Braiders, 1 of the Soulbright Flamekin, that's the 2 mana, mana accelerant trample thing, the Lord, and then 1 Inner Flame Igniter, the 2/2 that can +1/+0 your team for 3.
Right.
I was able to tap my Smoke Braiders and 2 mana to make all of my 3 attacking elementals into tramplers, then take that 8 mana and add 1 more and dump that 9 into the Inner Flame Igniter's ability to give my whole team +3/+0 in first strike. So now instead of a couple of 3/2s, I'm attacking with 3, 6/3, and 5/2 first strike tramplers. He had just played a Precursor Golem, which was like his splashy rare, thinking he was going to be able to block.
Okay.
He was like all block. I was like, okay, first strike, they all die, and I still do 9.
Yeah.
It was like pretty ridiculous. Like you could just do absurd things. Like I had 2 mana leaks in the main deck. I mean, you can like turn 2 Smoke Braider, turn 3 actually hard cast Moldrifter, draw 2, have a 2/2 flyer and still hold open leak, or like hold open snag, vapor snag and burst lightning, which I did like several times. I mean, just really powerful.
Right.
So I was too fast for him. I 2-0'd him. The next match, I played against the black-red aggressive, like, Bloodthirst deck.
Okay.
Those games were the closest, most exciting games I played the whole weekend. It was his Jean-Paul Mouton, I think was his name. He was from Germany. He didn't speak a lot of English. He was a really nice guy. These matches were incredibly close. Because the guy was a foreigner and didn't speak a great deal of English, and because he was just very, very focused, he had a poker face like few players I've ever played, where I literally, until the final moment, thought that he had me every game. Going into my 15th round of the day, last round of Magic, against none other than Paul Rietzel. One of my favorite Magic players, the last round of day two of my first day two of a Grand Prix against one of my favorite players. So Rietzel, we sat down, and I was pretty excited. You know, I introduced him on camera and everything like that, and he was totally cool about it. He basically was like, first thing he said was, how important are these pro points to you? And I was like, well, I mean, I don't go to enough of these events that the pro points are a huge deal to me. I want to do the best I can, and I'd like to make as much money as possible. He said, this match, the pro points are very important to me, as if I get them with a win here, I qualify for the World Championship, and my next opportunity to get those points would be to do very well at the Pro Tour, which is very hard to do.
And something to keep in mind in these situations is whenever you're discussing rewards and what's happening with the tournament and any type of draw split situation, it takes very specific wording to be able to pull it off, because anything said slightly incorrectly can be taken as bribing, and that could be just complete disqualification.
And to his credit, he had two different judges with him standing at the table that he asked to come over, I'm assuming, to make sure that he said it exactly right. And I said, look, can you speak off record or talk about someone else's situation to tell me what you're really asking here? Because if you want to split, he was like, until we've agreed on a prize split, there's nothing that can be discussed as far as concessions or match results. There is no conversation that can be had, and I have to be very careful about what I say and how I say it. And I was like, look, man, I'll be honest with you. I don't care. I want to play you a real game of Magic. I want to see if I can win this, because I want to finish, in my mind, X3, even if my record says X4. I don't mind splitting the prize. And at the end of the day, he was offering a prize split here regardless of who won, which was the bargain. I was like, I'll attack for lethal if you show me that I have it. I'll concede before damage. I don't care. So he was like, cool, excellent, sounds awesome. So we played the games.
He trumps you, right?
He didn't stop me. I lost 2-0. Like, the games were close enough. I didn't feel like I lost for any bad play reason. You know what I mean? He drew well. Like, I drew my bounce land early in both games and had to do the whole, didn't accelerate me thing. My deck's supposed to be very fast, so whatever. They were good games. He was real cool about the whole thing. So I think we will have him come on the podcast at some point here. But it was a lot of fun to play him in the final round of my first day two. You know, it was a nice sort of cherry on top of the weekend. I was going to say, you know, with the whole rules lawyering things, there are things that I don't know about that, you just, in fringe cases, you learn. Like, for instance, in one game, he had Wayfarer's Bauble on the table, which is the one mana artifact that for two mana you can sacrifice it to put a land into play from your deck. And I had a bounce land, and I played my bounce land and had 8 cards in my hand because I was on the draw. I went to discard. He said, wait, 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 you have to announce you're going to discard because I have to activate this Wayfarer's Bauble before you go to discard. Once you've gone to discard, your turn is officially over, and I can no longer have priority to activate this Wayfarer's Bauble. I didn't know this.
That makes sense. That happens on Modo. You don't really think about it.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that you think about discard and end step and cleanup is all kind of just a jumbled ending.
Definitely a very distinctive step-by-step-by-step process.
So that's cool. Obviously around a really good player who knows little tiny things like that. Because if he had done it otherwise, I wouldn't have noticed. Anyway, it was a great ending to the tournament. You know, I ended up getting 96th out of 3,800. Felt really good about it. I think I got one pro point, I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong, but I think I got one pro point
in
X4.
You're officially a pro Magic player.
Yeah, and yeah. It reminded me of how much fun it is to play at high-level events and do well. And, I mean, doing really well at high-level events is not something I have experience with, but playing at high-level events competitively and wanting to do well and really going into it with that attitude that you're going to do well, it was something I haven't really gone into in a little while. In a couple years, really hard. Most of the Magic I've played in the last couple years has been off-site testing, some local stuff, Kessler and I have played a lot of Magic, But really, traveling to a big event like this is not something I've had the time for in the last couple of years as much as I'd like to. So I think this might kind of inspire me to do more of it. More of it going forward, or try to make the time for it.
So if you could have done one thing differently this trip, what one thing would you do differently?
Probably not lose those two matches, X2 and top eight.
Don't do the crazy, wacky sideboard plan in game one?
Yeah, I could have beaten that guy for sure. His deck was good. My deck was better. And then the game against the guy that I made the mistake with the Novigen Sage's play. Granted, you never know, because losing the first round in some ways puts me in a better bracket against easier players. So going 7-0 my next seven rounds may have happened because I lost my first round. You never know. I can't guarantee it. But those two play mistakes cost me matches that I think I could have won otherwise.
Right. Now, this is something I kind of have theories on, but I obviously don't know for sure. But would you say that it's easier to play in day two or day one? Like, which one's more difficult emotionally, physically, and actually with technical ability?
Well, I definitely felt more accomplished two-one-ing both of my day two drafts, just because you figure day two of a Grand Prix is harder and draft is a more skill-intensive format in terms of, like, practical application of knowledge and skill. But I actually think that 7-2-ing a day one with no buys is a harder thing to do. So I think,
like,
that
even though day two you're playing against high level pro players and every single thing is very competitive, like, you're there already. There's no like you get two different drafts. So if maybe your first draft doesn't go amazingly, you can go into the next one. Where like a GP at 8 a.m. day one, you have to decide on the sealed deck that's going to carry you for 9 rounds of play
the whole
day. Get undefeated.
Yeah, the tough thing about sealed is that you can be 5-2 and feel really good about yourself. You get that loss in the 8th round and go to 6-3, and it's like, God, all of that?
Yep.
All of that? My day's going to end now? And you win that last round, you know?
Like, it's almost better to scrub out 0-3 than to go 5-0 and then just lose your last three matches, because at least the other way you have the day to do side events.
Yeah, it's definitely pretty tough. Otherwise, GP Vegas, though, was a really great event. I mean, the Command Zone guys, Jimmy and Josh, they held this awesome event on Thursday night. They got, like, 90-plus people together, listeners and players, and they got food and drinks, and everybody was playing Magic. They ran all these conspiracy drafts. It was really cool. We met a bunch of people who listened to both podcasts. If you're listening now and we met you, I met some awesome fans, like really smart Magic players, super fun to talk to.
Yeah, same.
It really kind of warmed my heart to know that there were people that were listening to us. I mean, we see the numbers, obviously, but to meet...
Actually interacting with you guys it's really cool to actually meet some of you guys in person versus just, like, blindly hoping someone's enjoying what we're doing.
Yeah, it's a whole different experience. I played some actual games of Modern with some people. It was definitely a lot of fun, you know. People, like, a couple of you guys actually, like, joked around with me and referenced Spellskite and Grand Architect. Like, that was awesome. So, that was really a lot of fun. Those guys did a great job with that event. And otherwise, I talked to a lot of pros there, all of whom were really, really cool. I think we may have booked some really good guests coming up in the near future, so we'll sort of see what happens with that. Obviously, I don't want to, like, quote any names other than Rietzel, who karmically owes it to us. But but aside from Rietzel, I don't want to quote anybody on the podcast quite yet. But I think you guys can expect some pretty great guests coming up in the near future.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, and we met, like, we hung out with a lot of other podcasters. So, like, the Brainstorm Brewery guys might be coming on the cast, and we might be going on their cast. Like, there's definitely a lot of cool stuff
the
future.
There's a new Magic social media network called The Meadery, M-E-A-D-E-R-Y.
Get on it. Shout out to those guys.
Yeah, those guys were awesome. They charged my phone for me. They gave me some sleeves. Just generally a really, really good site. Very functional. I'm not sure if it's themeadery.com, but if you Google Magic the Meadery, like mead, the sort of like drink you would drink if you were a Viking.
Right. Viking beer.
Viking beer, M-E-A-D, Meadery. If you check that out, those guys are great, and I really think that their site design is pretty elegant, like very easy to use. I was pretty impressed by it. So. I recommend checking that out. We went to an awesome Puka Trade party. Those guys are really, really cool, really nice to us.
Right. That's something I want to say is, like, generally, across the whole event, one of, like, everyone's super nice and excited to be there. Like, what's cool about the Magic community is we all love this game. We're all here to have fun. Like, even if you're not being super competitive, it's just, like, really awesome to kind of be in that environment where everyone's just really enjoying the whole time.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was a little mini documentary being made by Las Vegas City and Channel Fireball were teaming up to film something. And I think Kessler and I walked in ties, dressed up on day one.
Oh, yeah. If you're ever at a GPGC, guys in suits, it's probably us.
Yeah. And they started talking to us at the beginning of the day, I'm assuming because we had suits on. And at the end of it, they kind of asked me, how'd you feel about the whole thing? How was the event? What can you say? And what I told them, and this is sort of a similar message that I've been preaching for the last 6 months to a year, because that's when we've been doing this podcast, and I've really become a little bit more aware of where Magic stands socially. But the awareness socially of the game is at such a higher level right now, and the social acceptability of playing Magic is at such a higher level right now. You're seeing people of sort of more confident social classes involved in the game. You're seeing women. You're seeing young people. You're seeing couples showing up and playing together. It's like the social outcast stigma that was attached.
A mom and, like, 12-year-old son combo made day two at this GP. It was, there's crazy diversity. It's definitely a really cool environment.
Yeah, I mean, gone are the days where it's all dudes with poor social skills and, you know, like, there's a social stigma attached that is just, like, a weird thing. Like, this was Las Vegas. This was a 10,000-person tournament in Las Vegas. Like,
right.
It definitely just felt like something different, and I think we're really moving towards a place where this game is just... I mean, it...
Another cultural touchstone.
Yeah, it's almost there. We're approaching 30 million players worldwide pretty soon, and...
Big deal.
It is a big deal.
So Wallaby, we've been casting and going through... Ben's day two achievement. I've asked you guys on Twitter if you guys have any questions. So we're like in the middle of the desert. I literally just see weird desert bushes as far as the eye can see, both to our left and right, and a bunch of trucks. And then I think that's a bus ahead of us. So while we're in the desert, I'm going to answer some of these questions. Nicholas Harburg at Harburg. What tier two or three decks might be good at attacking the current metagame at GP Charlotte? So I think in general, I did some modern events over the weekend, and I really kind of liked Tron lists right now. I do think you kind of get hurt by the fact that there's just a ton more Full Metal Mages in the format. But beyond that, Tron hasn't shown up for a while, and like the decks that are out there, other than Burn and maybe Infect, which has fallen out of favor, you're pretty strong against a lot of the field. Like... Burn's your worst matchup, and you can definitely have a sideboard plan against them that really helps out.
I definitely think that Amulet Bloom is super unfair and is really good, and it's if you play that deck and you can actually learn how to do it correctly, which I don't think is quite as hard as people think, it's really just a question of man hours that you can put behind learning it.
Yeah, I don't think you can just pick it up, but I think you can do gold fishing just by yourself. I don't think you need an opponent to get good at that deck as much as you need with other decks.
Yeah, that deck I think is really good. I'm a fan of Tarmo Twin. I played against Tarmo Twin a few times this weekend, and I think that deck's pretty powerful. Traditional Splinter Twin is really good, but the one thing that's so good against Splinter Twin is a powerful card on turn two, like an aggressive card, like a Tarmogoyf. So I think that if Twin can play its own Tarmogoyf on turn two and then play Disruptive Magic, that's pretty powerful.
Right.
I'm a fan of that list. I think traditional Splinter Twin lists are good, and if you're a really good player with it, it's good. But I think there are enough cards that can mess with you that are running around. Unless you're super, super good with the deck and that's all you've ever played, people know how to interact with you, I think, on a little too consistent of a basis.
Right. All right, so the next tweet at us was from James, who is at Let's Go Terps. He asked us, hashtag Goyfgate ? Happy face. So for those guys who don't know, Pascal Maynard made the top eight of the GP. And, I mean, in previous conversation with pro players, he's mentioned, like, you know, like, I'm not going to a lot of GPs because it's expensive. I can't afford it. And so he first picked out of a pack that, like, in colors he's not going to play it, first picked a Goyf, foil Goyf, which is about, you know, a $500, $1,000 card. And a lot of random pros are freaking out, being like, yo, that hurts the quality of the game. This is high-level play. You should be playing, you know, at the peak at this level. It shouldn't be about, you know, an extra $1,000. And now the internet.
I don't think foil Goyf is $1,000. I think it's like $400.
Right. Well, that's what the people on the Twitterverse are saying. So, I mean, I personally think if you like, that's a lot of money. Even $500 is a lot of money. If you're already in a point where you can't pick it, I don't belittle him for picking the Goyf.
Absolutely not. I mean, look, the difference between at those high level tournaments, like what did I just say when I was talking about my drafts? My first pick in almost every pack was not a card I ended up playing. I played Moldrifter. I didn't play Arrest. I mean, you know, like pack two in my second draft, I first picked a Wrecking Ball, which I ended up only splashing in one game against Rietzel. I didn't even win the game. I mean, the powerful cards you first pick sometimes make the deck you play, and sometimes you switch colors, and that's just how it works. I mean, I don't fault anybody for opening $400 bills or $500 bills in a pack of Magic cards and saying, I'll take this instead of my pick. That's
right.
That's a ridiculous thing to fault someone for when you're talking about the amount of money that you're actually winning if you win the tournament anyway. If you win the tournament first place, it's $4,000. I think 5 through 8, it's $1,000. When Tarmogoyf is worth almost as much money as you're going to make for 5th through 8th place, I'll take Tarmogoyf.
Right.
I'm not going to say that the people who are calling or are criticizing him are wrong here, because playing Magic at the high level is not about winning money for most people.
True.
If you're in it for money, you're in it for the wrong reasons. But
I mean, I don't think anyone, I think there's some debate over if it was the right pick or not. I don't think it was the right pick. It's obviously the wrong pick. In fact, at Wizards Norman tweeted at us, and his basic tweet was, it's the wrong pick, but he has every right to draft what he wants, and the backlash against him is ridiculous. And I agree. I think it's so funny that this is even, trending on Twitter right now.
Goyf gate.
Everything's a gate now, too, which is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, the kind of movements behind hashtag gates are generally all ridiculous.
Yeah, totally.
So maybe we just need to move away from the hashtag gate idea.
I would agree.
I think there's always say with that. Ziggy Nix, who is at Ziggy Mondays. At the MMCast, top 10 silver bullet sideboard cards. Also, be careful in Bat Country, my friends. We will. If bats attack this car, we're taking them down.
Okay.
At least we're taking them down with us.
Top 100 silver bullet sideboard cards?
Top 10, not 100.
Top 10.
That'd be a long car ride.
A few things to talk about if you're gonna do top 10 silver bullet sideboard cards. Number one being, if they're silver bullets, you have to have some sort of a package to get them. So the first thing I'll say is if you're playing a blue deck with Trinket Mage, for instance, or Tezzeret the Seeker, that kind of a thing.
Engineer Explosives?
Yeah, I mean, you can think about
cards. There's a lot of different tutor packages for that card.
Yeah, you can play Engineered Explosives. You can play a single copy of Brittle Effigy. You can play Torpor Orb. You can play...
Yeah, all those one-drop artifacts that are still playing in the format are pretty good.
Ensnaring Bridge. You can play Relic of Virginitas. You can play... there's a good, healthy amount of cards that can be played in those decks.
Right.
In those decks, artifact decks.
And then if you look at, it's hard to talk just pure top 10, or at least without doing a whole episode on the subject. But if you look at, Amulet Bloom, they played a lot of singleton, just big green creatures that are just, vaguely slightly better in different situations, like Sigarda and Hornet Queen and Thragtusk. And that's because they have the green pact to be able to, Primal Pact?
Pact of Summoner's Pact.
Summoner's Pact. And, because it kind of lets them search out the right card they need at the right moment. There's just generally, what would be more interesting is actually even just the conversation of the top 10 cards that allow you to have the singleton kind of sideboard plan. So not necessarily the actual targets, but more like Fauna Shaman or Tezzeret or Trinket Mage or Teleria West. There's definitely a lot of cool cards that let you have those silver bullet packages.
Yeah, all those cards are cards we love. I mean, Fauna Shaman's a great one, definitely. Obviously, Pod before it was banned.
I mean, I think if you're looking for specific real targets, going for high level but very specific hate cards. So stuff like Malira, for instance, which if you're not playing the combo, but it just shuts down Infect. So having that in your sideboard as a one of, if you have a way to get it, great. Having stuff that there's a whole group of hate bear cards, really, I guess is what I'm saying, that are pretty good. I mean, we were just talking about earlier today about Tunnel Ingus being just the nuts against
Tunnel Ingus is awesome,
which
that
is a card that whenever the second every time a player plays an additional land after their first one a turn, they take 2 damage.
An opponent. It's a 2-1
an opponent.
Two.
Right. So it can just wreck an Amulet player pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's really, really good. That card's a great example. Another one you can talk about that is sort of silver bullety, that's way off the radar, and this is one, I don't know if any of you guys know this card or have ever thought about it. There's a card called Vedalken Ethermage, and it's a tutor from Future Sight. Now, the card itself is 1 blue, 1 colorless for a 1/2 flash Vedalken Wizard, I think, or Vedalken Artificer or something like that.
Okay.
When it enters the battlefield, return target sliver to its opponent's hand, but the one ability on the card that nobody pays attention to.
Or, well, like, I'm pretty sure that's the only thing people pay attention to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just it's the thing that's, like, not the obvious point of the card.
It has Wizard Cycling, which
right.
for three colorless, you can discard this card.
At instant speed.
At instant speed. Search your library for a wizard card, put it into your hand. Now, the number of wizards that are very, very powerful in Magic, to name a few, Vendilion Click, Snapcaster Mage. I mean, there's a handful of awesome ones, but
right.
really good cards that are very powerful in blue decks. So, and that's also a colorless card, the cycle ability. So, that's a pretty interesting one. You know, you can get Changeling cards, for instance. You can cycle
right.
that for Nameless Inversion or Crib Swap.
No, there's definitely a lot of cool ways to do the searching. Well, if you're coming just pure singleton. I really like Wear and Tear, actually, in this category of just, like, a random one-of card. If you have, like, one slot left and you're 15, you're just looking at a random card. Because it's pretty decent generally. Again, it's a lot of matchups and it covers a lot of bases. Plus, it's like if you only need Artifact Hate against the deck, it's great. If you only need Enchantment Hate, and it kind of covers some bases. So, yeah. So, moving on. Joey Swangler, at Lil Wag with three A's. How many main deck Anger of the Gods / Volcanic Fallout / Pyroclasms are too many? ? #Scred. I think anything more than five. I'm going to go with five.
Main deck, you say?
Main deck.
Yeah, I mean, unless it's a deck that has a way to, like, discard them for value, you don't really, I think, four in a main deck,
well,
unless it's a really, really oppressive metagame where you need to be playing more.
I mean, generally, these are the kind of decks that are playing Boros Reckoners or effects like that, so, like, you gain some advantage off the fact that the damage that these do to your own creatures do damage to either your opponent or creatures.
Sure.
But I don't think, like, board wipes aren't great in Modern, and maybe they're, like, I do think Anger of the Gods is really good right now, so, like,
Anger's
playing
good
three
for
to
sure.
four, because, like, Collected Company decks are everywhere, Elf decks are now a thing. I definitely think I like Anger of the Gods right now. I'm not sure how much you want to play more than four of that type of effect, though.
I would agree. Yeah, it costs three mana, as we've said in Modern. Three mana in Modern is a really, really tough tap-out number, so two mana in Modern is, like, the manageable number. I mean, the lesson we've learned about this format, the constructed format, has not changed from turn two is the most important turn in Modern, turn four is the game winner. So if you do something great on turn two, great. Now your mana has to be open for turn three. If you're playing a strategy that's all in or aggressively linear, you have to win on turn four. Otherwise, play a different deck.
Well, and that's why generally Pyroclasm gets considered more for main decks, because it is the turn two drop. So you can play it on turn four as a two drop and then keep counter magic open or something along those lines. Mind you, Scred's a sweet deck, but I think we're going to move on.
Yeah, totally.
Sean Campbell at SEC Campbell 1118. Was Ben able to convince Paul Rietzel to come on the show?
Yes. Yes, Paul Rietzel is coming on the show. He's this is going to be awesome.
Yep, so hopefully that'll happen. Alex Ballou. Ben mentioned a brew while he chatted at GP Vegas that you guys chatted in GP Vegas that had Pack Rat. Let's hear the tech. Do we want to do that all right now, or do we want to wait for another episode?
I think we have to save it for another episode.
Yeah,
that, the
we're
brew-
already at... almost 2 hours, I think.
What?
I don't think we can... Oh, sorry, never mind. That's not true. We're at like an hour 20.
This brew that you mentioned that does play Pack Rat, I've been working on it for a while now. I've probably played something like 60 to 70 games. It's probably one of my favorite brews I've ever made, and I will share the tech. We're currently teching a second version of it right now to see if we can come up with a better version that I'm playing, but as soon as I am ready to take it to an event...
So to talk a little about it, there's definitely a good engine that, you know, are obviously a lot of people are already on the Collected Company train, but Ben has kind of figured out a few other additional cards that definitely have a lot of really interesting play with each other, and it's a really strong engine, and the deck we have built right now is very strong. I mean, it's in testing, which is obviously not, you know, we haven't had infinite games, but 55 against Junk. Pretty good against Splinter Twin.
Oh, I would say more than... Splinter Twin's your best matchup. It's like 65%.
Right. So it's definitely doing a lot of strong things. And we want to make sure that this engine is like being optimally used with some of the looser cards or cooler cards that we're playing with, or if it should be something else. But right now, pretty sweet. We've definitely been doing a lot of testing. Normally, I'm drinking some Haterade on the Ben Brew train. But like this one, I definitely have a little bit more faith in than normal. We definitely will be doing a deck tech in the future.
100%. This is no Haunted Handsome, guys.
Shout out to Bear Valley Road. Currently, I think we're like officially hitting the outskirts of Los Angeles. Like, there's a few little more like bastions of small desert towns, but we're generally getting into Los Angeles.
I'm gonna give you a preview. Kessler and I were trying to come up with a name last night for the deck. We don't have a name we like yet, but one idea that was tossed around, and I'm just gonna tell you guys the name, and you can see if you can come up with what's in the deck, was Superior Burning Coconuts.
I'm a big fan of Burning Hot Cocoa.
Oh yeah, Burning Hot Cocoa. So that's kind of something we were talking about, and you guys will see if you can guess, and yep. We'll do a tech very soon.
Cool. Now, you know, as always, we want to give a shout out to the Command Zone. They threw an awesome party in Vegas. Those guys are great. They do great Commander content. I personally will eventually soon be on their podcast. So, you know, that'll be happening. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter. We are at the MMCast. I am at Kess Wiley.
And I'm at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter, Instagram, and occasionally Periscope.
And, you know, if you shout at us while you're listening to this right now, we'll shout right back at you. Please go review us on iTunes. We've been giving away packs to every 10th person who comments and rates on our iTunes page. That'll go up until we have 120 comments. We don't have any more packs in the bag after that point. But it's really important. It makes it so other people can find us and we can kind of grow the podcast together. Big shout out to everyone we got to meet in Vegas. You guys are awesome. We had a great time. Shout out to the Brainstorm Brewery guys. Shout out to everyone else. I had a blast.
So much fun.
And then congratulations to all the Hideo guys who made it the day two. That's 10 players. That's insane.
10 players, yeah. Huge, huge stuff. Hopefully, you know, the train continues. If you're ever in Santa Monica in Los Angeles, go to Hideo Comics for Tuesday night draft and play against a bunch of pros. It's a really good store.
Yeah, so we'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot for listening, guys.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.